you very much, everybody. Your dedication to the cause of women, peace and security is much appreciated. It's been a fantastic day, but it has been a long day. So I'm delighted to welcome you to the keynote, actually, for this workshop with Professor Fionnuala Ni-Eloin, who has come to us from the University of Minnesota and also from Ulster, who has a wealth of experience in international law and feminist critiques of transitional justice, is co-founder of the Transitional Justice Institute, and has a bibliography so extensive I cannot possibly begin to read it out because it would take me the full hour and a half. So she's inspiring and terrifying in equal measure, and always, always insightful, and I'm delighted to welcome her to talk to us this afternoon. And without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Fionnuala.
Thank you. So I'm really delighted to be here. Part of the reason I'm exceptionally delighted to be here is all the people I cite regularly are in the room too. So that is just, it's a huge bonus. Today I'm going to speak to a feminist response to countering violent extremism and counter-terrorism agendas. That's broadly kind of the area that I'm going to drive my comments towards. And the title of my talk is taken from my favorite poet, Seamus Heaney. And I want to read this poem and then we'll talk about it in the context of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. Seamus wrote this poem in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And he said, "Anything can happen. You know how Jupiter will mostly wait for clouds to gather head before he hurls the lightning. Well, just now, he galloped his thunder cart and his horses across a clear blue sky. It shook the earth and the clogged underneath, the River Six, the winding streams, the Atlantic shore itself. Anything can happen. The tallest towers be overturned. Those in high places daunted, those overlooked regarded. Stropped beak fortune swoops, making the air gasp, tearing the crest off one, setting it down bleeding on the next. Ground gives. The heaven's weight lifts up off Atlas like a kettle lid. Capstones shift. Nothing resettles right. Turric ash and fire spores boil away." So let me just see, am I getting this next? So, when Heaney's poem was written in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, it was a stark acknowledgement of worlds and tectonic plates shifting. "Anything can happen" is a literal warning about unforeseen destruction, the grim unexpectedness of the tallest towers being overturned, those in high places daunted, and the horror that can manifest when those who have been overlooked force our regard through violence, atrocity, and spectacular revulsion. And so my comments today and this talk are really placed in the context of what happens to and for women when capstones shift and when ground gives way. And so that giving way has resulted, that post 9/11 giving way has resulted in states moving to create and strengthen a new legal apparatus that meets their post 9/11 needs to address violent, transnational and non-state actors, including but not limited to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The new international security regimes which were created post 9/11 are they're literally the foundations of this new world that we've come into. And they were ushered in by UN Security Council Resolution 1373 of 2001, a resolution that was birthed almost in the same breath as the Women, Peace and Security Resolution. Not only was this new international security regime born through a Security Council resolution, that Security Council resolution came uniquely with an institutional apparatus. That institutional apparatus was the creation of the United Nations Counterterrorism Committee. This Counterterrorism Committee, which I'll talk a little bit more about later today, sits just right below, in the institutional apex of the United Nations, it sits right below the Security Council itself. It has essentially the same structure and membership as the Security Council, the P5 states plus rotational states. And I would argue and have done in previous work that one of the shifts that happened was not just the creation of the CTC, but actually the movement of security regime management down from the Security Council into the CTC itself, in ways unnoticed and unheralded, and in ways that created sort of a closing off of space to engagement with state priorities. So the CTC itself becomes a sort of an institutional bedrock for a new counter-terrorism structure. But it also comes with other things. These include, for example, in the European context, a whole set of European Union regulations on combating terrorism, which broadly came under what used to be the old Justice and Home Affairs piece of the Maastricht Treaty. And you have this, in addition to the sort of regional networks that were created to enforce these new security regimes, we also, I think, got a whole new set of patchwork regulation, including multilateral treaties that address very specific aspects of the counterterrorism space. And these build on, right, so you've got this new post 9/11 architecture of a committee. A super resolution is how I think we would describe 1373. And then they sit on top of a patchwork of existing multilateral treaties on terrorism. So you've got this incredible consolidation and securitization of a much bigger space than had hitherto existed. So once you put these pieces together, what you get is an expansion, a considerable expansion of the scope, content, and institutional power of international security regimes post 9/11. And it is in this universe into which WPS is born. And we shouldn't, I think, forget it. So let me just say, in some ways repeating much of what's been said today, What do we birth? What gets birthed in the WPS agenda? Well, as all of us in the room know, the WPS agenda is and has become the dominant discourse framing women's advocacy and action in international affairs in the past 15 years. It is birthed through a Security Council resolution. And that movement into Security Council space is a really important symbolic and power move by transnational women's actors, who recognize that, of course, the Security Council as the primary actor in the peace and security arena, and the relative absence of gender considerations in any work done hitherto to the Security Council, that there was, in some sense, a necessity or an opportunity to access that space using the language of gender equality, gender rights, and the relevance of women, peace, and security to the peace and security domain. And of course, it came at a fortuitous time. That access point, of course, really manifested before the full specter of these security regimes had in fact consolidated themselves. They were literally being created and being bedding down as the WPS agenda came into place. It's interesting, if you were to compare UN Security Council Resolution 1373 with UN Security Council Resolution 1325, you would notice a couple of very different things. One is that the terrorism resolution, or the 1373 resolution, is a resolution that creates very specific obligations on states. It includes the obligation to legislate in particular ways around terrorism and counterterrorism. It includes an obligation of absolute reporting requirements under 1373, almost unseen in that point in Security Council resolutions. And many international law commentators have described that resolution as being a sort of a quasi-legislative resolution, creating a new role for the Security Council, a super legislator, as well as this sort of domain in which peace and security gets addressed, in particular through Chapter 7. And what's also noticeable, I think, is that, of course, 1373 came with this institutional architecture, this duplicative architecture that reproduced the Security Council in miniature through the CTC to ensure the enforcement of 1373. And again, by comparison, while the Women, Peace and Security agenda got a resolution and importantly inserted itself into Security Council space, it certainly got none of that institutional furniture. It got very little by way of benchmarking or requirement, and it sat in the kind of stagnant universe of sort of regular Security Council resolutions, which might or might not gain traction. Now, I think there's much to be critiqued about the WPS, and I am going to do a little bit of that today, but I want to focus briefly, it will be brief, on the valuable contributions of WPS to international affairs, and in particular to women's engagement with war and peace. First of all, it's put us in that space, right? It's sort of produced a nexus between women's experience and the war and peace terrain in a way that's visible to the international community. The second, as I've written about, and some of you have heard me speak last night included about, it's produced a political vocabulary of benchmarking and requirement that has required states, not just through 1325, but through these other, through the subsequent 8 resolutions, to do certain things, right? So it's given us a vocabulary that's been seized upon, particularly by women civil society activists, in a way that's quite unexpected, right? Because actually it's not entirely clear when the resolution was produced that was its goal or its intention. So part of the anything can happen here is that even when you do produce a Security Council resolution, it has this capacity to mould and shape itself in ways that may be entirely unexpected. The third thing that it's done, so it's the symbolic importance, the vocabulary that we've gained. It's also, I think, clearly resulted in new state positioning and attention to the particular experiences of women in conflict. And most notably, it has drawn exceptional attention to the ways in which women experience harm, physical harm in conflict, with, as many of us have noted, possibly some undue attention to penetrative sexual harm over other kinds of harm. Notwithstanding that the Security Council resolution itself left open that a whole range of experiences might well, in fact, be included within the domain of women, peace and security. Now, one of the things is, in terms of thinking about what this Security Council resolution was intended to apply to, one of the things I've argued in the piece I wrote for International Affairs that's just come out that we launched last night, was that the Security Council resolution was intended primarily to apply to traditional armed conflicts between states. That is to say, our understanding of the arena of war and peace to which women were being given an entry pass were traditional armed conflicts. These would be conflicts covered by Geneva Convention Article 2 as supplemented and augmented by the additional protocols of 1977. For reasons that I'm happy to address more in the Q&A answer, it's entirely unclear at that time whether, in fact, states were offering women and the Women, Peace and Security agenda an entree into other kinds of conflict, particularly conflicts that would be covered by Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions and maybe even Protocol 2 conflicts. And the reason for that is not specific to the Women, Peace and Security agenda. It is to say that in these areas of internal or contested conflict space, where the threshold, where it's happening primarily within the physical territory of one state, that there has long been a historical disquiet or ambiguity by states to any external scrutiny. So WPS is not special in this regard. By and large, states have been highly reluctant to see conflicts occurring within their own territory, whether they be civil wars or high-intensity communal conflicts, to be subject to the law of armed conflict. So as a result, the kind of territory, I think you have to understand, the kind of territory to which WPS was attached was conceptually a very particular kind of conflict. And these other kinds of conflicts were largely presumed to be outside of the domain, because states have good reason to keep the international community at large and other states out of those kinds of conflicts. But of course, simultaneously, just as you have this kind of schizophrenia about which kinds of conflicts does WPS actually attach it to, we had the launch of a global war on terror, to which the adjective war was applied, but not the law of armed conflict. And we had the sort of selective state invocation of the terminology of armed conflict without any of the applicable legal norms. We also, in this same period, so I'm talking about the early 2000s, as a result of post 9/11 and the specific requirements imposed on states as a result of the CTC's regulation, we had the requirement that states adopt anti-terrorist legislation, even those who didn't have terrorists, right? So in the CTC reporting, there's some hilarity when you read early reports by states saying, well, actually, we don't have a terrorist problem, therefore we don't need anti-terrorism legislation, to be promptly told by the CTC that didn't really matter whether they had or they didn't have terrorists. They needed the legislation anyway. So we have this parallel language of national security regimes, emergency powers in the parlance of the United Kingdom and other places. We also have in this space some derogation from human rights treaties. So states saying, we're facing this incredible set of challenges post 9/11. For the UK, it was also post 5/5. The UK derogated from the European Convention on Human Rights in the immediate aftermath of the London bombings. States saying, well, look, we're not in a position to guarantee the full and effective protection of human rights in our states because we're facing these terrorist threats. So this very messy landscape in which on the one hand you have a WPS agenda primarily associated with a particular type of conflict, coexisting with the emergence of other forms of conflict regulation, primarily the refusal to accept the application of the law of armed conflict to a host of post 9/11 conflicts, and the use of national security regimes to do the work that might have been done by the law of armed conflict. And one of the reasons I want to point out why that's so important, because I think now, and this is particularly in the context of the new Security Council resolution, I think we're actually seeing all of these threads coming together in a way that we need to remember that history and understand why and how it was that the resolutions were birthed, and the context, the broader national security context in which the counterterrorism regulatory system locates itself. So that was the beginning. As the October meetings in New York revealed, we now have a new Security Council resolution. And this Security Council resolution 2242 marks, I think, a new turn in the WPS agenda. And this new turn is the inclusion of countering violent extremism, terrorism and counter-terrorism into the fulcrum of the WPS agenda. And I want to suggest that that move is an extremely problematic one for a number of both conceptual, doctrinal and symbolic reasons, and that's what I'm hoping to talk to for the rest of the day. No, I'm not going to keep you here all day, but for the rest of this conversation. So what do we have in Resolution 2242? Well, the high point of 2242 was, as many of you know, it was a pretty extraordinary passage. You know, it was like a baby celebration on speed, right? There were so many people showing up to celebrate. Nala was there, and some other people in the room were there. What do we know? Well, we know that the resolution on the 13th of October marked a bunch of extraordinary statistics. 68 states gave speeches on the day. Large numbers of organizations, the League of Arab States, NATO, the OAS, the AU, the OSCE, all platformed that day. In addition, the discussion lasted over 9 hours. There were 111 registered speakers, and 72 countries co-sponsored the resolution. And so the celebration and the self-congratulation on display was affirmative of, like, the importance of states' recognition, on the one hand, of the Women, Peace and Security agenda. But I want to suggest that had we not had countering violent extremism in this agenda or in this resolution, there would have been no resolution and there would have been no party. Because primarily, many of the states, in my view, were showing up because CVE was in the resolution. And I think as feminists, we have to be extraordinarily skeptical when that number of states and that number of masculine interests coincide to celebrate a women, peace and security agenda. Because I don't think fundamentally that they're celebrating a WPS agenda. I think they have another agenda, and they're using the agenda to do that work. So what does the newly minted resolution do? I'm going to focus, there are lots of other things in this resolution, and I don't want to minimise the value of those, but I think the real game in this resolution is countering violent extremism. And that newly minted resolution specifically highlights the role of women in countering violent extremism, and the image today is intended to present who we think might be that person. It's also intended to address the rise of extremism. It particularly looks at issues like the displacement of women through extremism, as well as direct and indirect violence experienced by women through extremism. The resolution specifically calls on, quote, the participation of women and women's organizations in developing strategies to counter terrorism and violent extremism, which can be conducive to terrorism, including through countering incitement to commit terrorist acts, creating counter-narratives and other appropriate interventions. And I think we already see the impact of this resolution. It's been invoked in a number of subsequent Security Council resolutions. I would particularly focus on Resolution 2253, which is the resolution addressing threats to international peace and security caused by terrorist acts, specifically the expansion of the sanctions framework to include ISIL. One of the things I would put a bet on, right, is the following. I and other scholars have tracked the invocation of 1325 since its inception in Security Council resolutions. And in the International Affairs article that just was published, I track over a year, about 18 months of Security Council resolutions and the extent to which 1325 has been invoked. And it's incredibly patchy. And even when it's invoked, it's not invoked consistently. There's no golden thread working through the invocation of 1325. I want to bet, I'm happy to take any bets, on the invocation of 2242. I think we're going to see consistency of invocation. I think we're going to see regular invocation. I think we're going to see, precisely as we saw with the CTC and reporting to the CTC, if you compare human rights reporting to the Human Rights Committee or any treaty body, what you will find is states report late, inconsistently, and sometimes badly. What do you find when states report to the CTC? They report on time, early, and comprehensively. I think we're going to see exactly the same pattern for some of the reasons that we've identified in human rights advocacy in reporting on terrorism as a reporting on human rights as we're going to find duplicated, I think. These patterns will be duplicated in this arena. So let me then move on to say a little bit about why it's so important that we as feminists are focused on this resolution and the implications of this resolution. I'm going to say something obvious, which is that it's really important that feminists engage with terrorism. And CVE is an important space and place for women and feminist scholars to address. And from a feminist perspective, with some very notable exceptions, and some of these people are in the room, terrorism and counter-terrorism have long been of only marginal interest to mainstream feminist theorizing. And what that's meant is that actually there's been a dearth of engagement by feminist scholars with national security issues and with extremism issues. Now, we have some exceptions. This is a picture of a woman. Anybody want to guess which organization she belongs to? No, but close. It's European. Yes, it's a picture from Belfast of a woman in the early 1970s, probably belonging to an organization called Common Naman, which was the women's wing of the IRA. So I think to say that there hasn't been feminist engagement at all doesn't recognize, of course, that there's long been, I think, policy and scholarly interest in the category of female combatants. There are multiple studies of group from European left-leaning groups like the IRA, Common Naman, the Baader-Meinhof gang. And we've also had studies of post-colonial national liberation organizations and women's engagements in these kinds of organizations, the PLO, the ANC, the Tamil Tigers. Much of this study has focused on the mobilization, why do women become violent? Some, including my own work, has focused on the relative lethality of women in these organizations compared to men. It's also true, I think, going back to this image, that increasingly we have a focus on female jihadists. And there's a particular, I would say, almost fetishization of the violent politics of women who engage with violent extremist jihadi groups. And I do think it's an interesting thing, given the tiny number overall, this sort of relatively speaking, the tiny number of women involved, that this preoccupation with the violent and generally presumed aberrational female is itself a product of a certain kind of essentialist discourse that requires a critical eye. But by and large, in the field of terrorism and counterterrorism, men remain the primary and visible actors in terrorist acts and in counterterrorism responses. And in the legal field, the concentration has been and remains primarily on male legal actors. When women come into view in terrorism and CVE discourses, they typically do so as the wives, daughters, sisters, mothers of terrorist actors, or as the archetypal victims of senseless terrorist acts whose effects on the most vulnerable, usually women themselves, underscores the unacceptability of terrorist targeting. Women remain marginal to the conversations in which definitions of security are agreed upon, and they're generally peripheral to the institutional settings in which national security frameworks are implemented as policy and law. Women, as I've said, perpetrators of terrorist violence, are largely ignored or fetishized. With some exceptions, I think of Mia Bloom and Lindsay O'Rourke, we've had very little attempts to understand what motivates women in this way. But I think what's interesting for me, and as I was setting right this talk, I was reviewing a whole range of literature, both legal literature and political science, IR literature. And what I notice is that there's a clear commitment by many feminist scholars to making a case for gender, quote, as an analytical category, right? So we see pleadings for including in women. So that would give a space to address women victims of terrorism. It also allows you to address women as combatants or as terrorists. But what we have very, very little of, I think, is very little feminist analysis of terrorism as a phenomena, and very little exploration of terrorism as an essentially contested category or concept from a feminist perspective. If feminist theorizing is on one account, as Scott has described it, a primary way of signifying relationships of power, how might we in fact apply a power analysis to the ever-expanding site of terrorism? Might we, as Cynthia Enloe repeatedly tells us to, display a feminist curiosity about the definition of terrorism? Might we want to move out of an analysis that merely marks women as objects of protective attention in terrorist discourses, or subjects of purient interest when they are violent? Might we want to avoid the taken-for-granted status and nature of terrorism itself? For President Putin these days, it is the moderate Syrian opposition. So who is your terrorist? And pause to think about who gets to define who is a terrorist. Who gets that label, and what does it mean? And what does the use of the word terrorist or terrorism exclude in our conversations about politically, socially, religiously, and structurally motivated violence? So, who is a terrorist? It's long been the case, of course, that the challenges posed, terrorism is not a new phenomenon. I lived in Belfast most of my adult life and know that reality up close. But for many states, post 9/11 has brought a new urgency. The Seamus Heaney's anything can happen, anyone can be a terrorist, and has brought new urgency and vibrancy to state action in the area of counterterrorism, and has expanded the counterterrorism space enormously, both domestically and internationally. And it's hard. The use of the term terrorism and counterterrorism pose enormous conceptual and methodological challenges. The term has become ubiquitous in contemporary state conversations to describe the actions and views of those who disavow the state or use violent methods to advance their political beliefs and ideologies, including Chechen opposition, including Russian dissidents, again, pick who you decide it applies to. And the term is clearly provocative, and it's intentionally pejorative, as it places those included within the ambit of description as outside the realm of acceptable behaviour and signals their exclusion from agreed-upon social and communal boundaries. My concern has always been, in Belfast in 1990 and today in 2016, is that the term precludes deeper conversations about the causalities of violence, as well as reflections on the conditions conducive within the state on engendering violence. Much of the legal and political literature is rife with sweeping generalizations about the nature and form of all kinds of violence directed against states. And what that does, what that has done, and what this resolution does, I think, is discourage any attempt to disaggregate the phenomenon of terrorism from other forms of violence. Now, it's not my goal today. I would not do this justice, and I've written a couple of books, so I'm synopsizing. My goal is not to revisit the definition of terrorism, but to acknowledge that the absence of precision in the legal terms, including in the failure to agree a multilateral treaty on terrorism in the Sixth Committee for over multiple decades, is really to limit the way in which we, if we don't have that engagement, and we're rushing into a countering violent extremism and terrorism, counter-terrorism discourse as feminist scholars, we're actually running to that headless, like headless chickens is what my grandmother would say. I think for feminists, the reflections on the ways in which a focus on particular acts of violence, generally to the body and to property, avoids engagement with structural and pervasive violence in ways that ought to give us pause on the adoption of the category itself. At the very least, I think it ought to prompt our critical reflection on the need to judiciously tease out the category, moving to an emphasis on precision and nuance and application, and a focus on acts of terrorism, for which we have pretty good international and domestic definitions, specifically in the sense of civilian targeting as the core of the acts to which the legal concept should be applied. And I do want to say it's hard to have this conversation. The term terrorism shuts down the capacity to have a conversation about the legitimate use of force by state and non-state actors in the context of wars of national liberation, occupation, and armed conflicts falling within the mandate of the 1977 additional protocols. It's also the case that the baggage that we bring when we talk about terrorism, or the perception of baggage, is that it puts you, or me, as I stand here and say that we ought to think about this category, in the seeming other category of being an apologist for unacceptable acts, which I am not. But not to do so invites a certain intellectual dishonesty and a superficiality of engagement with what I think is an ultimately contested concept, one that we all ought to be deeply uncomfortable with. And as we watch, and for those of you who work in the national security arena, as I do, as we watch the term being widened and deepened across multiple places, including the criminalization of things which we now call material support to terrorism, in countries that shut down legitimate opposition groups and limit freedom of speech and association, it's very clear that the practice of terrorism and counter-terrorism and violent extremism is having all kinds of downstream effects. And this same analysis can be applied to CVE. So I'm not suggesting that there isn't a core of consensus on what can or cannot be understood as extremism. But I think around that, there's a very large and deep penumbra of ambiguity that we ought to be extremely wary of. So why are we, I'm going to take 5 more minutes and then I'm going to stop. So then why are we in this, why are feminists, why are we at all in this arena? Why is WPS in the CVE and the counter-terrorism space? Well, first of all, it's actually utilitarian. We always know, and I think we have to understand, women make pragmatic choices all the time. We negotiate with ex-combatants, we negotiate with combatants, we deal with all kinds of unpalatable realities in the management of conflict and in the management of political space. And it's really clear that the CVE counterterrorism space is a space in which legal, political, economic, and symbolic goods are being distributed. And if we're not there, we may not get them. And we may think we need them, although I think that's an open question. It's also clear that this is the security space. So one of my critiques has been that even though if you talk about my birthing story, right, the birthing story of WPS, which is in the context of a particular type of conflict in a particular moment, it's really clear. It's not the conflict space to which, I mean, there are some of those spaces left. The annexation of Crimea and eastern Ukraine is one such space. Sites of occupation may be another classic space in the occupation in the application of the four Geneva Conventions. But in fact, part of the problem for the relevance of the Women, Peace and Security agenda in the last decade and a half is perhaps we've been at the wrong party, because all of the international peace and security work, or much of the international peace and security work, is in fact being done in that space, and we're in this space. We're also being made welcome, sort of. Lots of people showed up to the party in October. Again, I'm a little concerned. What's that? There's a phrase for, you know, beware of devil's holding gifts, or something like that is what comes to mind. But beware of those bringing gifts to you, right? There's an old Irish phrase for that. And of course, there's the reality, another pragmatic question as to whether or not there are gains to be made. And I think part of the reason transnational feminist activists found themselves in this space was they thought they could make gains. I'm not so sure of that. So what I will say in closing is that I think that, in fact, one of the lessons, and I set out some of this history in the international affairs piece that I wrote, is that if we look at the engagement of human rights activists in the counterterrorism space from the events of September 11 onwards, what we see is that actually their gains have been tiny. When the CTC was established, the space for civil society and human rights engagement was non-existent. There was none. And the then High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, spent most of her tenure and those who followed her seeking to create a tiny little foothold in the CTC. And what that tiny little foothold has resulted in is a small space in which a human rights expert gives technical expertise to the CTC and can, if asked, offer that to states. And that's after 15 years, I think, of fairly advanced advocacy. And the gains, as we've seen in that space, have been, I think, they've been minuscule. And if that's what we're holding out for, I'm not sure that's worth the cost of being in the space. Equally, learning the damages and the cost to the human rights movement of its this is my closing one, you gotta wait. the damages to the human rights movement of engaging in spaces where your agenda is shifted by virtue of engaging with the priorities of the securocrats in some ways means that your capacity to make the claim is diminished or undermined. So I think that poses us with a quandary. I don't have an answer to the quandary. And I think that the challenges for policymakers are different from the challenges perhaps to academics. But I would say that just as Heaney imagined anything can happen, it seems to me also possible to imagine a universe in which we make a different choice, where we think very seriously as an intellectual community of scholars about how we think about the space that we're engaged in and try to fundamentally reframe the space itself. There's a danger that what we're in there is figuring out strategies to get women in rather than thinking about the space that we're in and how it's defined. And I think that's the big piece of work. There's also, I think, resistance and choosing to resist the kind of securitization language which we do see in the global study, and an important call to action to avoid the space being securitized. And finally, I think there's opportunities for partnership, because all around the world, partly as a result of CVE policies and countering terrorism policies, we see a massive closing of civil society space. Massive. And let's be clear, that is connected to and intimately related to the security regimes that have been created post 9/11. And if we don't create marked, meaningful partnerships with the broader array of groups that are being affected in those civil society spaces, I think our positionality is weakened. So I had to finish with this, going back to I was online looking for who's your terrorist. This is an actual petition, and it's sort of slightly scary how many people have signed it. And it brings me back to Heaney and to say that I think some of the fear here is our fear of stepping outside of the known universe that we have post 9/11. And that's what limits us more than anything else, is the fear that we cannot do something different. And I think we have to be open to the possibility of absolutely thinking and doing something different and allowing just anything to happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Fionnuala. That was thought-provoking, as always. We're going to take some questions. I think it's quite likely we're not going to run until 5:30 because I think everyone could probably use a breath of fresh air before we reconvene at the reception. But I'm very happy to chair some questions. So I'll open it to the floor. It's very likely we're not going to run until 5:30. Louise.
Thank you very much. Definitely thought-provoking. What, from your perspective, would be the alternative for WPS advocates? It is sort of the security context that a lot of us are working in. So if it's not the sort of the pursuit of an integration of WPS and CVE, where we have seen that it's been completely gender-blind up until the last sort of 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
What's an alternative strategy?
Yeah, I think I would say two things. One is, what do we mean by not being gender blind? So I see a universe in which CVE is perfectly gender integrated, but really destructive to broader. So you can imagine a universe in which we do gender well in CVE by some measures, but that the effect of the overarching security policies is actually entirely counterproductive to long-term peace strategies and to addressing the causes conducive to the production of that violence in the first place. Violent extremism is the outworking of something. It is not always, I'm not a proponent of the entire irrationality thesis. We have to, in just as we treat other phenomena and understand the causes that produce the violence. Certainly, for those of you familiar with Northern Ireland, and there are many of you in the room, some of these discourses are deeply familiar around, you know, and as it happens, the non-state actor group is now in government. I'm not suggesting we're going to end up with ISIS in government. I'm not suggesting white rabbits on the moon. But what I am saying is that it's also extremely... I think self-defeating to view these things in ways that make them entirely unopen to challenge, right, or unopen to understanding the phenomenon itself. So what do we do? Well, one is to really ask yourself whether including, putting gender into that space is a plus or a minus. I think you might get gender recognition, but the overall context is one which is not necessarily a liberal move. We're not necessarily think of the number of states who have countering violent extremism policies these days as a pretext for shutting down every legitimate opposition leader. Look at Turkey's decision this week to close one of the few remaining liberal newspapers in Turkey on the basis of countering violent extremism. So I think it's just a very challenging space for us to be in. And my view is, you know, what does it look like if you step outside of it? I don't know. I certainly do know that in Northern Ireland, in the women's sector, we made a very clear choice not to be in that space and to do our work differently. So I think there are examples of how to do it otherwise.
Gina?
I have a comment and then a really confused question.
Sure.
So just on Turkey, I think it's worth thinking about what's happening in the Kurdish region.
That's right.
Putting gender equality at the heart of it.
Yeah.
That's connected then to the kind of state repression as well. So that's a comment.
Yeah.
The question, which I'm not sure quite how to formulate, but I feel like I've been living in a slightly different universe where I've been mapping where protection of civilians and narratives, and particularly force mandates that use peacekeeping mandates that have force components that use the protection of civilians as their mandate, and mapping how that parallels the Women, Peace and Security agenda. So I don't know where it sits alongside this, but it's just interesting that for me what I've been looking at is that there's parallels to Women, Peace and Security is the rise of the idea of protection of civilians
right.
as a justification for force,
particularly
right. under peacekeeping mandates.
Right.
So I think it ties together.
Right. I think that's entirely right. I just think it's also important. I mean, I'm going to sound like a very doctrinal international lawyer when I say that international law also recognizes a legitimate right to self-determination. It's in the UN Charter. International law also recognizes under the Geneva Conventions the right to resist occupation. And these are legitimate reasons to use force. I'm not suggesting these are structured within legal frameworks of understanding that under unjust regimes, think of the Geneva Conventions were produced in response to a Nazi regime that occupied most of Europe, subject and killed millions of people, and we recognized in law the right of folks to actually rise up against that and to use force. The UN Charter, going back obviously to the Treaty of Versailles and before, recognizes this instrumental right. Now, don't get me wrong, that right is deeply contested. Who is a people for the purposes of self-determination? I'm not suggesting, but I'm saying that we have occluded that language from our contemporary discussions. You cannot talk about these rights anymore without being presumed to be a terrorist sympathizer. And I think that's extremely dangerous to democracy. I think it's extremely dangerous to international law. And I think that it will come back to bite us, like literally come back to bite you. And the CVE space is in effect a co-conspirator in that enterprise in ways that those who craft it don't even see, perhaps because they don't see the lessons of history.
I think maybe my instinct is who the Security Council demonizes and who they protect or save maybe works hand in hand, and maybe the protection of civilians narrative is the saving bit that works.
Right.
At the same time, simultaneously. So
right.
Yes, I.
The groups that you're speaking about aren't the civilians to be protected.
Right, and it's. Right, and of course it's really clear again, we work in highly ambivalent frames. The civilian combatant distinction, as many of us knows, is being broken down in practice in conflict sites where we have folks engaging in active participation in hostilities. Who's your combatant, who's your civilian? Those lines are becoming increasingly blurred, and I think I recognize the immediate and proximate challenges of managing that both as a matter of law and a matter of policy. But it is, I think, you know, at the level of, let's say, the countering CVE piece, let's be, you know, and again, I think about who are the women on the ground. So I can only speak to the communities that I have lived and worked in for over a couple of decades, and saying that, in fact, many of the women, also men, that were ultimately instrumental in negotiating a peace process were people who were deeply connected to the non-state actors. And if we had a no clean hands principle, we would not have had a peace agreement in Northern Ireland. We would still not have a peace agreement in Northern Ireland. Now, I'm not saying and I'm not suggesting that the transfer of that particular, that's a highly specific, it was a conflict in a Western democracy. There are lots of unusual features to that. But it is to say that, again, when we're talking about who are the women who are likely to be at the forefront of the countering violent extremism, what's our definite, you know, how pure do those, you know, how clean are their hands for them to be? And then, frankly, how useful are they? But more than that, it is the sense that actually the complexity of violence production in these communities and the communities that I have lived and worked in for most of my life is extremely, it's non-linear, it's not always clean, and it is also connected to issues that are deeper socioeconomic and identity issues that will simply not be resolved by calling people extremists, actually. So.
Anna, did you have a question?
Yeah, this is again not so much a question but more of a reflection. So I was very much involved in the negotiation of the 25 agenda, and we pushed very strongly for a goal on peace, governance and justice, which we hoped would address the causes of violence and security, which is done. However, there is a target on the Gulf of Spain looking at strengthening national capacity to countering terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And we pushed back very strongly against this during the negotiations, but obviously it remained.
Right.
And a lot of other national actors were very skeptical towards including a goal in security because they were afraid that the aid and development agenda would be securitized. And it kind of did. So it would be interesting to hear your thoughts about other entities and policy frameworks being, you know, sucked into the counterterrorism agenda.
I mean, I think the spaces are multiple. I mean, they're so one is clearly the migration space. Asylum, the attacks that we're seeing on the asylum and refugee, the 58 convention, I think, is clearly connected to these discourses. I think so. That's one enormous space. I think we're also seeing, and this, for many years, I spent most of my work doing, you know, standard, what you might call standard national security law. And one of the things that, for many years, I have paid attention to is the way in which domestic legislation, which is initially framed narrowly to address terrorism or security issues, moves into the mainstream. So there are multiple examples of that over time. So let me give you a simple example. The right to silence in the United Kingdom. The right to silence was it's a common law, old common law right. It was first removed in Northern Ireland for terrorist suspects. It was removed because of the belief that it was harder to charge those individuals with crimes because they wouldn't speak. And at the time, the arguments made in Parliament were, this is a really narrow group of people. It's a really problematic group of terrorist actors who are conditioned to being detained, and they know how to avoid interrogation, and they're just not speaking. So the resolution is, let's remove the right to silence from this very narrow group of people who are really bad actors, and it doesn't affect anybody else. And of course, what we saw in the United Kingdom a number of years later was the broad removal of the right to silence in the United Kingdom as a whole. So we see the transfer of specialized regimes from, in domestic law, this is through my own and others' work, really well documented. We also see very particular changes to the form of governance. So generally speaking, under national security regimes, we see a consolidation of executive-type powers that are often justified in the name of national response. So the current French response to the horrific attacks in Paris are a good example of that. And the argument was, we only need this for 3 months and then we're going to stop. Guess what? So there's one of the things we know historically is that states and state actors become extremely, whether in democracies or non-democracies, become extremely comfortable with the additionality of power given to them under exceptional regimes. The second thing we know is that those exceptional regimes consistently move into the normal law. And if you think you can ring fence them, we have undisputable data that tells us. So my concern is not only that we're seeing these security regimes affecting very particular spaces, so it could be migration or aid, but that actually the downstream effect of that, if we track what we know from domestic law, the normalization of the exception, is that you're going to see the same in international law and international legal regimes. That's my happy prediction for the day.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. Very interesting. I'm wondering something, which is, if you are sort of advocating for removing the gender dimensions within the CVE space or the development of the CVE space, frankly, because we're not really there as far as what it is yet. Is there a way to, instead of, you know, sort of advocating against that and thinking we should remove it, sort of advocating for it to be instead added somewhere more strongly, which would be more appropriate, potentially like Human Rights Council? If you're really hoping for a more rights-based approach, why focus so much on the security sector? Why not say, you know, this discussion needs to be a counterbalance within the human rights framework?
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is, the security sector is now this space that you talked about, and you very rightly point that out. And so maybe the idea is that it needs to be counterbalanced somewhere else where we can continue to advance these thoughts around gender equity and plurality and a sort of liberal perspective on that, while at the same time making sure that those structures inevitably are merging are also able to address this issue. Is there some third way here that doesn't, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, as they say?
Yeah, I guess my concern, and again, these are just partly, I'm still fully thinking out my response to the Security Council resolution, sort of intellectually and policy-wise, so this is just a really first attempt to do that. My caution is first to our, like, embrace of the space. Like, I do think that as feminist actors, we have to decide why we're in that space. The second thing is to caution against naivety in that space, because it doesn't mean you shouldn't be in the space. Human rights actors have been in spaces that have long been inhospitable to them. But I think there's a degree of sobriety about what they're getting and their understanding of the limited traction they have in the space. So I do think that's the starting point of actually being a little, more pragmatic and less optimistic, because I actually think that's more realistic about what you're doing in the space. It's also to say, we really need to think about why we spend all of our energy in this space to make these miniature gains. And the lesson there is really, and we've had a great deal written about this, I think, well documented by human rights advocates and scholars, is what happened to human rights advocacy in the counterterrorism space. That is the instructive lesson here. Anybody think it's really going to be different? And that was when the system was emerging and consolidating and there was some more open spaces to do the work than there is now. Where do I see the counterbalance? I think that's really important. The counterbalance for me continues to be states, treaty, human rights obligations under international law, where particularly many of the democratic states, and I think we've seen this, I would say, again, from the point of view of, for example, the United Kingdom's engagement with issues of terrorism, one of the prevailing counterbalances in Northern Ireland throughout and in the aftermath of the conflict was we consistently litigated at the European Court of Human Rights. And notwithstanding, of course, the issues around lag and there's a delay, we were able, I think, advocates, you know, again, across the political spectrum, those committed to the value of upholding the rule of law, even in situations of extremity, were committed to saying one can do these things, but within a framework of law, and one can be human rights compliant in the context of countering terrorism. So I do think we have actually more traction than we think, and that the robustness of those systems, and some of it requires, I think, feminist actors to invest in those spaces too, to recognize that under the treaty systems you have this capacity. And we've actually seen, again, I think very little feminist work in the, again, it's speaking to the sort of feminist engagement in counterterrorism. There's one really interesting, the Khadr case in Canada, which has raised some very interesting questions about the gender dimensions of Mr. Khadr's wife when he was rendered through the United States and subject to torture and inhuman treating, but it's in the response to his position that the state's system, the Canadian system, recognized the harm, the gendered harms that his family has experienced through the application of counterterrorism policies. I just don't think we've done enough thinking, imaginative thinking, about what those cases and spaces look like. The second thing is we now have the CEDAW comment, general comment. And I also just think there is this dearth, and it's maybe a plea for, you know, feminist theoretical and scholarly investment in this space and thinking really, thinking outside the box and thinking within the box. Because again, the number of women writing in the counterterrorism space is like minuscule. Minuscule. There's a handful of us doing that work. Really, it's tiny. And I think that's actually a challenge to the academy's response, but it's also a civil society gap in response to this space.
And on that note, given one of the themes of the convention, of this workshop, is challenges in the post-2015 Women, Peace, Security agenda, I will let that challenge sit with you overnight and you can consider your responses through to tomorrow. What I would like you to do is to join with me in thanking Fionnuala, and then I will talk a little more about housekeeping. So we'll do the applause.